First of all, I want to thank you for the invitation to be here. Some of you are new in politics. Some of us are a little long on the tooth. I'm here really because George Sorger, with whom I've had a relationship for a lot of years, and I have been corresponding for many, many years on environmental issues about which he is very passionate. And George contacted me and wanted to know what was going on with one of the passions of his life, which was the legal case. And he wanted to know whether I was going to roll over and play dead on the Red Hill Creek. And I said, well, of course, I have no intention of rolling over and playing dead. In fact, I have sought the approval for legal counsel. And I'm happy to tell you that I've received a letter from the Prime Minister of Canada, which authorizes legal counsel by the Department of Justice to myself and all other defendants in the Red Hill Creek case. So I'm very pleased. And I only got this letter this week, so I gave a couple of copies to a couple of people in the media. Think about this. Most of you don't realize this, but when we went through program review in the early 90s, there was a move afoot to close down the Canada Centre for Inland Waters. Now, the Canada Centre for Inland Waters employs about 300 people in science-based jobs. And when we went through program review, for various and sundry reasons, I managed to keep it alive at a time when it was originally on the chopping block because the fisheries minister of the day offered it up as one of the cuts. Most of the people on the list that are being sued are actually employees in that building. So you can imagine the goodwill that Mayor of Hamilton and the legal team at City Hall is spreading in threatening to sue all these people who are out working on the science of Hamilton Harbor, the science of oceans, the science of navigable waters, which is what their job is. And I'm very pleased to say that George Sorger got in touch with David Anderson. I haven't spoken to him personally myself, but David's view was, you know, I'm vigorously going to defend this case, and nobody should be sued for doing their job. I have to doubly question the modus operandi at City Hall when those young people, you know, there was a survey out this week, a national survey saying that young people do not trust the political system. Now, you had some young people who stood very firmly for the principles that they believed in. They were arrested. Now they're being faced with huge legal bills from the city of Hamilton because the mayor and those bullies at City Hall think they're going to intimidate people into not caring about the environment. And I think that if I were to come here for one reason tonight, I'm not running for mayor. As a matter of fact, legally, because I'm a defendant in a lawsuit by the City of Hamilton, I could not put my name forward because it would be in prohibition of the Municipal Act. I am here to say that the green message is extremely important, and it's a message that must come from the people. And I've taken some time tonight, which may be rather tedious and laborious for those who are not really in-depth interested in the environment, but I made a presentation which I thought was worth talking about tonight, which lays out some of the perspectives of the challenges that governments face when they talk about going green. I've entitled the speech, Going Green, Rhetoric Versus Reality. All political parties campaign on an environmental platform. During elections, everyone is green. All the political parties come to you with a very strong environmental platform. Unfortunately, after the election, reality hits. And I remember becoming a part of the government in 1993, and I'll just outline some of the promises that we had laid out in the 1993 Red Book that I think are worth reviewing. The Liberal Red Book in 1993 promised a 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. We promised a review of all financial disincentives to environmentally sound practices. We promised national environmental assessment legislation. We promised an Office of the Auditor General for the Environment, which we did deliver, as well as the National Environmental Assessment legislation. We promised new national legislation on toxic substances and the creation of a new national roundtable on the environment, reporting directly to the Prime Minister. When I became the Minister of the Environment, I was told by the deputy, that was politics, this is government. As new minister, I was told point blank by my deputy that the promises in the Red Book were politics and should be set aside now that we're in government, because that was politics, this is government. The Department of Finance at the time worked hand in hand with anti-green departments, like the Ministry of Natural Resources and the Ministry of Industry, to block environmental progress. My first experience, and I'll give you this because I think it's a fairly relevant example, was we had actually been in the middle of changing the regulations for pulp and paper. And at that time, there was a proposal that would have required the modernization of all pulp mills across Canada for a closed-loop system. My first experience as a minister was a tremendous lobby encouraging me to overturn the regulatory changes that had been proposed by my predecessor, who at that time was Jean Charest. But Jean Charest had laid down this roadmap which required all pulp and paper mills in Canada to develop a closed-loop system. Departments lined up, created a scare campaign in the media, and worked aggressively to kill the proposed regs. I was blamed in the media for the loss of, quote, thousands of jobs in Eastern Canada because of my intransigence, because I refused to back off on the modernization of the pulp mills. Because we were early in our mandate, I was able to get the support of the Prime Minister, and we went ahead with the closed-loop system. And ironically, not a job disappeared. In fact, we created a closed-loop system for pulp bleach because green was in and we were early in the mandate. Years later, I was told by Fishery Minister Robert Thibault that jobs in Nova Scotia's pulp mill industry were actually saved because they were allowed into European green markets when other North American pulp products were kept out. So instead of the modernizations actually costing jobs, they saved jobs. But at the time, what you saw were the media headlines saying thousands of jobs at risk, which were lobbied by the companies that did not want to make the modernizations. And when the jobs were saved, nobody wrote an article saying thousands of jobs saved. One of the key objectives that we were never able to achieve, and I think it's really key to getting where we want to go in terms of global warming, we had committed in 1993 to doing a complete overhaul of the tax system. Because if you want to change environmental practices, you need to use the market system. If water, for example, is almost free, people will overuse water. And until you start attaching the real cost of environmental degradation to our purchasing cost, you will not get the desired change. What you'll have, and what you will have now in the new program for global warming, is you will give grants to the companies that are actually doing the polluting. So we had committed to doing a complete overhaul of the tax system, and it was to be done jointly between the Department of Environment and the Department of Finance. We were each to appoint 12 people. Environmentalists were so frustrated with the process because it took almost 2 years to set up the panel. Every time we would propose names to the Department of Finance, if they were too environmentalist, they'd throw them back and say, we can't have those names. So we jockeyed for 2 years in naming the panel. And at the end of the day, the chairman, who was Jim McNeely, who had a pretty good series of credentials on environmental disincentives, eventually got so frustrated with the process that after about 4 years of two steps forward, three steps back, he packed it in. We had promised a complete overhaul of the tax system to put green behavior on a level playing field, and we could not even agree on the names of the panelists. So instead of tackling disincentives, which is really the key, the tax system is the key to environmental sustainability. You have to address the disparity between financial incentives for oil exploration, which is a non-renewable fossil fuel, compare those to wind power. And when we almost abolished energy alternative exploration, and at the same time we were giving out billions of dollars of tax incentives for oil exploration. We eventually produced a report which made a few positive changes for green behavior, but left the big issues largely untouched. We created the Eco Trust, which was, I think, a very sound initiative, and that's the trust where you can actually set aside land and get a tax incentive from the government for land that you set aside in perpetuity. We took the tax off of recycled lumber to try and put it on a level playing field with virgin lumber. We made a few small changes, but by and large, we couldn't reach a concession on the big issues. 10 years ago, the IPCC gave us the roadmap on global warming. They reviewed the facts, and the verdict was in. The cause was human. The solution had to be human. 10 years ago, in preparation for a world solution to global warming, we began the homegrown work. The first federal provincial meeting to solve global warming was held in Saskatchewan, and I co-chaired the meeting with the minister from Saskatchewan in 1993. Our department at the time, Environment, had the lead on climate change and worked vigorously to get the other departments on side, all the while facing opposition within government from the Department of Natural Resources and Finance. I was given a mandate by Cabinet to head the Canadian delegation to Berlin. And at that meeting, I was joined by two environmental experts, the former Quebec Environment Minister and colleague Clifford Lincoln, and former Federal Minister, the Honorable Charles Katcha. While we were working for a solution, the then Natural Resources Minister, Anne McClellan, was working with the then Finance Minister to get my negotiating mandate revoked. So they were in Ottawa extremely upset because we were actually looking at agreeing to a greenhouse gas reduction of 3%, although we had promised 20% in the Red Book. With the support of the Economic Cabinet Chair at the time, and I literally had phone calls passing back and forth at midnight, he said, "What the hell's going on over there?" I said, "Well, China is about to leave the table, and if China leaves the table, we will have no agreement on global warming for the world. We've got to get them back to the table, and we have no credibility if, as developed nations, we say we're not prepared to do anything." So I was able to hang on to the mandate, and the Berlin Conference Chair, Angela Merkel, who, by the way, was the minister here in Hamilton when we hosted the G8 meeting, we managed to get the LDCs, the less developed countries, on side when they were prepared to walk. And that was the pre-meeting to the Kyoto Accord. We did reach a world agreement to begin reductions at greenhouse gas emissions, despite objections at the time from the countries in what they call the Juice Can Group, which is Japan, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and us. We fell out with the Juice Can Group because we agreed to 3% reductions. But at the end of the day, we managed to pull a consensus for the world, and it set the stage for Kyoto. Each group returned home to begin the implementation, to implement the road to Kyoto. I came home to an organized campaign by the oil patch to turn the Berlin decision around. A letter was sent to the Prime Minister demanding that I be removed from my position, leading the climate change work, because I was too pro-environment. Within months, I was reassigned to a new portfolio, and the lead for climate change became, guess what, the Department of Natural Resources. In my new portfolio, I was responsible for Parks Canada. So I set my environmental sights on transforming the national park system. The Parliament of Canada passed a new law ending development in our national parks. Canada's oldest park, Banff, had been put on the watch list because excessive development was threatening its status as a World Heritage Site. Historically, ministers are lobbied behind closed doors. And one of the things that I did, which probably didn't get a lot of attention around here, but for which I feel really proud, is when I brought the law forth, prior to the introduction of the Canada National Parks Act, every decision on development in every national park was the decision of the minister. So it doesn't matter how green the minister is, if a developer wanted to develop, they'd eventually just beat you back. And if it wasn't me, it'd be the next minister. So what I did with the Canada National Parks Act, we actually have a plan in each park which becomes part of the law. So if they ever want to reintroduce development into Banff, it cannot be behind closed doors. It has to be as part of an act of parliament. So you put the decision in the hands of parliament, it makes it much more difficult to cut deals with developers behind closed doors, because the development issue is a huge piece of that. The template for the changes to the Canada National Parks Act was the Banff Bow Valley Study, which was actually commissioned by my predecessor, Michel Dupuy. The study came to me, and it showed that Banff Bow Valley was in a state of serious deterioration, and that environmental stress was not unique to this national park area. It was the launch pad to the new Canadian Parks Act, which, by the way, was supported by all political parties. It sailed through the House. Even the reform at the time, Jim Abbott, supported it because he knew it was good and supportable legislation. We launched a full parliamentary review, didn't get a lot of media because everybody was on side, and usually the media is interested in a fight, so it didn't get a lot of national coverage. 80% of Albertans supported the legislation, which made environmental impact the single most important factor in any national park decision. The ski developers hired a local journalist to promote their viewpoint, and a series of stories which completely misrepresented the broad public support appeared in, guess what, the newspaper of this journalist, the Calgary Herald. While the public, including all parties and a vast majority of Albertans, supported the legislation, if you read the local newspaper, you would think that it was crazy Sheila from Hamilton sort of standing out there on her own. Those same developers managed to convince the regional media that Canada's work did not have the support of the people. And those same developers are now making noises about meeting with the new minister so he can reopen the heavy-handed way that they've been dealt with by Parliament. No more backroom deals in parks. Crosby Cotton, who was the journalist at the time who went to work for the developers, are not the only ones who misrepresented public consensus. Only have to step outside this door to see how indiscriminate development and the absence of urban planning is destroying ecosystems in the Golden Horseshoe and creating unlivable communities. I lived with the power of the developers, the oil patch, on a macro level. You live with the power of the developers every day on a micro level. The downtown core in Hamilton is a disaster, while City Hall issues permits that completely grow out the urban footprint. If you want to know why the downtown of Hamilton is in a disaster, follow the money. And in the last 15 years, the major investments have not been made in the downtown core. With the decision to expand out the urban footprint, there are a few developers who will make a lot of money on quick flips, but you're also bleeding the center of the city dry. The heart is on life supports, and one government building, which we did deliver, or one discovery center, or one rehabilitation initiative in the downtown core is not going to stop the fact that there is not an urban vision in this community. We're choking on our own air. Winter smog warnings, and I don't know if you heard the news today, but 5 years after Walkerton, almost, I think, 40% of Ontario communities have had water problems in the last couple of years. And we're still not learning the lessons of proper water treatment. Yet, when it comes to governments, ordinary citizens despair of having their voices heard. And all the, and this is a point that I think is pretty relevant to the environmental movement. Power is never given. In all the years that I was in politics, I never saw anyone give up power, including myself. In fact, the tendency is to guard and limit power, because the less others have, the more you think you have. In fact, that is not true. Green Canadians have the capacity to take power, particularly if we lay out an aggressive roadmap between elections. Get organized now. You have your first foot in the door with significant public support in the last municipal election. You put environment on the agenda. You must force all political parties, municipal, provincial, and federal, to stop taking the green vote for granted. Make going green a fun place. I think people also have to recognize that the movement is a place where you can explore and enjoy life. Because what's the point of having a beautiful environment if you don't wake up in the morning and smell the roses? So I think we have to be a little less morose and a little more uplifting about the future. And I say this because I have a pair of Birkenstocks, but environment is not just for Birkenstockers. It is for every parent who cares about their children. Work to ensure that Canada does not backpedal on CEPA, on toxic waste legislation, on funding for political parties. That legislation permits growing movements to get your message out with the support of the public that voted for you. It also permits long-standing supporters of other parties to park their vote in a place where their concerns will not be ignored. The new laws will cut back on the power of corporatism to deflate the environmental agenda. Some people in my own party have already talked about changing the election financing laws. They must be stopped. The new law guarantees the beginning of a more level playing field. Minority governments make good greens. Survey after survey shows that the Canadian people are increasingly cynical about the political process. That crisis is an opportunity for a movement with a green perspective. You know that the Green Party made significant gains in the last election, and interest in the environment continues to grow apace. The movement of the environment, the environmental movement today is akin to the acorn. The seeds have been planted. With nurture and nature, you can grow tall and mighty. Believe in yourselves and believe in your mandate. A Canada where green is not measured by dollars. And if I can speak in a very personal way about this community that I love so much, I spent the better part of today traveling around Hamilton with Karen Shopswich, who's the director of the television series that I'm working on for the History Channel. And I took her to some places that I call places of the heart. And one of those places of the heart is the Hamilton Harbor. And I stood on that harbor, on the banks of that water, when the Chamber of Commerce, the major steel industries, the Seafarers Union, and quite a large group of interests oppose the opening up of the harbor for their own reasons, some of which are disparate. I spent 7 years, and I have to give a lot of credit to the previous mayor, Bob Morrow, because Bob and I spent 7 years working on that agreement. And I can tell you, I did not work harder on any agreement in any part of Canada than I worked on that harbor deal, but I was on the phone from morning until night, and I fought a corporatist agenda that did not want to open up the harbor, because they liked the fact that they could store steel coils there on waterfront land for nothing. Now, ironically, a few months ago, I had one of the vice presidents at Dofasco who came up to me and said, I want to apologize, and I won't name him because it's not relevant now. He said, I want to apologize to you, and I said, why? And he said, you know what? He said, we fought you on the harbor. He said, but you were right, and now I see the potential. If the people of the city want to know where potential is, ask yourselves why the major plank of the current mayor to save Hamilton is to build a road to get you out of it. No, if a bypass is the best that you can promote in the name of urban planning, then the situation will continue to deteriorate. If, however, you use the opening up of the heart of Hamilton as a kickstart, and I was really thrilled to see the opening of the expansion of the art gallery with Louise Dampierre, because I think that's amazingly positive for the downtown core. But it has to go way beyond that. The private sector needs to step up to the plate. The federal building right now, I drove by the other day, it's a disgrace. There's graffiti on the side of the wall, there's windows poked out, and you know, I had an agreement actually, a tentative agreement to have Mohawk College move down there with their for adult education. It was blocked because somebody wanted to sell the building to developers who were going to build a condominium. Now, I don't need to bore you with all the details of it, but the way that it works in government, if you have a building that goes on the auction block that you don't need, it's offered to other departments, and then if the federal government doesn't want it, it's offered to provincial governments. So the Ontario Realty Corporation snapped it up, ostensibly because they had a very hot development prospect. And we were actually working, I was actually working with the then minister, the provincial minister, Brad, about actually, Mohawk was very interested in putting 1,000 students down there, which would have been amazing to revitalize that area. The thing did not go because the Ontario Realty Corporation flipped it and sold it to a developer. The building is sitting there right now, you know, the entrance into Hamilton, and it looks like a gaping hole. Where are the property standards? How do we allow a vacated building under the authority of the Government of Canada to be sitting there looking like former Harlem? And I say former Harlem because when Bill Clinton moved into Harlem, they actually got the place cleaner than some of the properties in downtown that are just left to rot. So I think that there are solutions, but I think the first solution has to be that the young people in particular should not be intimidated. The lawsuits of the city of Hamilton are a frivolous attempt by the current administration to divert attention from the real issues, and that is their lack of imagination when it comes to urban development. You only have to look around downtown Hamilton to see the potential. More 19th century Victorian architecture than any place in Canada. Water. Cityscapes that are absolutely astounding. I mean, the raw material you have to work with is unbelievable. So let's ignite the imagination of the young people. Let's raise some money for the young people who actually are facing those legal bills. I'm happy to tell you that the Prime Minister has said that he will cover my legal bills in the fight, because I certainly do not intend to walk away and be sued by the City of Hamilton for doing my job, and I fully intend to work with all of you who want to help make Hamilton the kind of place that it could be. When I left politics, I was actually given a lithograph by a friend of mine, and it's a picture of Hamilton as it was in the mid-19th century. And it's taken from the escarpment, and it shows the downtown, the beauty of the harbor, the way that it was a meeting place for people. It was just astounding. I think we can bring that back. And I think the first steps have been the decision to link all the parts of the harbor under one path. I think people are starting to rediscover the beauty of Hamilton, and it really is an incredibly beautiful place. So let's build on the beauty, and let's support young people. And don't, on the one hand, say that you want to reinvigorate young people, and on the other hand, sue young people that try and express their democratic right. It's sad. And don't be intimidated by the developers. I mean, so many people in this town are scared to death of being blackballed by the developers. They can't hurt you. There's more of you than there are of them. So get together, stick together, and grow green.